Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle. Thank you for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com. And, you know, check us out wherever you find podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, or the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel, where you will get every episode of the podcast, as well as quick take reviews. The most recent one I published was for the Oscar nominee F1. And you can find that at the YouTube channel. You can also check us out at patreon.com/sonic cinema. I am finally caught up and ready to get started in 2026 on there. I just posted Leaving the Collection a couple weeks ago. I'm ready to go for any film festivals I cover. I'm ready for the Oscars. Well, I'm theoretically ready for the Oscars, to at least discuss those, and that is at patreon.com/sonic cinema. So it's funny because of the fact that I think we had gone, it feels like I'd gone, we sometimes go several months without talking to my guest today, but it seems like he's by far the most frequent guest we've had recently. He was on with us in October when we talked about War of the Worlds and the many iterations of that book. He was on in December where we were talking about militaristic action movies and action movies that propaganda as propaganda for my Fascism in Cinema series. And today we are going to be talking about, we're going to be taking a left turn from both of those. We're going to be talking about a classic Hollywood thriller from the master of suspense himself, Alfred Hitchcock. It's one of his lighter films, and I know it's one that both my guests and I have a strong affinity for. And the film is his 1955 movie, To Catch a Thief, and the guest is Phil Faso. Phil, thank you very much for joining me once again.
Brian, I will say what I always say when I come on. It is always a pleasure, my friend. I'm always happy to join you on here and delve into another brilliant discussion on film, which I think we're going to get today as well, as usual.
Definitely. And, you know, we're recording this on Super Bowl Sunday because, let's face it, neither of our teams are playing in the game. So we don't have that same anxiety going that could possibly be come up for fans. I wonder what that's like. I haven't felt that in about 10 years when the Falcons shit the bed with the New England Patriots.
Yeah.
Go Seahawks.
The last time I was excited about a Super Bowl for the Raiders was, the first decade of this millennium. So it's been close to a quarter century.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it's different when you have no investment in it. Like, you talk about anxiety, but I'd also have a lot of excitement. I'd be jumping through the roof if the Raiders were even in the playoffs. And, you know, well, here we are. We're talking about a great film instead of watching some great football, so.
And you know what? I'm fine with that. I'm perfectly fine with that because I love the that we're talking about. And so To Catch a Thief, to put it in some sort of perspective with Hitchcock's career, this was during the 50s, which is arguably his strongest decade, or at least the one that most people will gravitate towards. Because in this decade, we get The Trouble with Harry, we get The Wrong Man, we get a remake of The Man Who Knew Too Much after this, with Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day. Before this, we got Rear Window and Dial M for Murder. And then we also get Strangers on a Train early in the decade. We also get Vertigo and North by Northwest at the end of this decade. And here's To Catch a Thief. This is in his, I think this is the last film he had with Grace Kelly in it. And this also had his other significant leading man beyond Jimmy Stewart in Cary Grant. And, you know, it's easy to point to movies like Rear Window and Vertigo and North by Northwest and go, that's greatness. That is just semi greatness. That's awesome. I love that movie. I think something like To Catch a Thief is great for a wide variety of other reasons that go beyond, that are not as complicated, maybe in terms of the narrative, but just the craft that goes into them when it comes to a movie like this.
So I'm going to reiterate something that I said, I believe, on our Joseph Cotton episode of Sonic Cinema. I am not really a big Hitchcock fan. I've never been, right? And coming from my background, being a big horror guy, you would think that my favorite would be Psycho, because that's most horror fans' favorites. They go to that. Psycho has a really great second half. I'm not very involved in the first 45 minutes or so, which is the build-up to getting her to the hotel. When I think of that when I watch it as a kid, when I watched it as a kid, I always remember it starting like right before she gets to the hotel.
Yeah.
So I kind of like push that all off, because the first 45 minutes are just, and again, don't get me wrong, Jet Li is great in that film, every part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole thing with the setup with the money does not hold my interest at all for those first 45 minutes or so. And you'd think if I was going to be an outlier as a horror fan, I'd love The Birds. And The Birds is basically a cheesy B-movie made by an incredible director. And he does a great job of it. It's a lot of fun. And if you haven't seen The Birds, you should.
But yeah.
I love this movie for the same reason that critics criticized To Catch a Thief when it came out. It's not heavy. It's light. Mm-hmm. It's breezy. It's not much of a mystery. It's got a quick murder in that you forgot about when we were talking about this recently.
Yeah.
So it's easy to forget that somebody actually gets killed in this, and it's off screen, I think. And you don't really see it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Hitchcock in the middle of a run with a bunch of heavy, heavy films. Like Rear Window, psychologically heavy, right? Vertigo, through the roof, psychologically heavy, right? Yeah. The Dial-M from Murdy Hill is tense, really high grade, next level mystery suspense films that he's making. And this sneaks in as it's just this cool little film. You have two beautiful people. You couldn't pass two more beautiful people to be your actors, your leads in this, with Grace Kelly and Cary Grant. Mm-hmm. You have a fun, light story. Cary Grant, without the pressure of, you know, having to run away from biplanes in this movie and hang out the nose of one of the people, one of the presidents on Mount Rushmore, right? Just lean in and enjoy the humor of it. And he gives a great performance here. This is one of my favorite performances. I wouldn't say that this is one of his greatest performances, but this is certainly one of my favorite performances of his.
Mm-hmm.
Grace Kelly, I mean, the problem is she didn't make that many films. I think she made 8 films, and then she got married and became a princess, and that was the end of it.
Yeah.
So this, I think, it might have been like a film or two before she got married to Prince Monaco, I believe it was, right?
Yeah.
So I think is right before that. And I think that had she hung around, and again, she had a tragically young death, unfortunately, but had she hung around and made a lot of movies, I think we'd be looking at her even on a higher level than we do. She's considered a really great actress, but I think she could have become a generationally great actress had she acted more.
Yeah. No, I think that's completely fair. And I think what you say about both performers is absolutely true. You know, and I think, you know, not just because of the fact that this is essentially a crime caper. This movie kind of reminds me of Soderbergh's remake of Ocean's 11, right? Where you just get this premise that just works like clockwork. You put a lot of great, handsome people at the center of it. And then you just let them be who they are. And I feel like that's basically what Hitchcock is doing in this one. And I mean, he basically is filming at the Cannes beachfront and the French Riviera, which is just a breathtaking location. And I mean, this is a movie where this is a movie where you sort of watch it to sort of go on vacation. Like you're going on vacation with these characters more than you are watching a story. Now, the story that unfolds, like you said, there's not a lot to it, but it's really just an elegant, beautiful looking movie. And this is shot by Robert Burks, who would later go on and shoot Psycho for, or shoot Vertigo for Hitchcock masterfully. And this is just a fun little caper, and I think that's one of the most charming aspects of the movie.
That's exactly why I love it. You know, it's yeah. not. And again, if I'm saying that, if I were to tell you that this was my favorite Hitchcock film, which it is, you could legitimately look at me and say, "Oh, you're not really a big Hitchcock fan then." And I'd say, "Yeah, I'm not." But that's this film just suits me perfectly. And
yeah.
I love when we do these because I'm always thinking on, you know, like five different levels when we get together for these. So it starts off really interestingly because you find out that there's a quick scene of jewelry being stolen at the beginning, and then you get introduced to our character, Robbie, okay, portrayed
yeah.
by Cary Grant. Now, I found it interesting when I was watching this a couple months ago, because that was after we did the Joseph Cotton episode and talked about The Third Man. This is also a movie that takes place, and you wouldn't really think of it this way, but it's also a film that takes place in the shadow and aftermath of World War II, just like we did with The Third Man. So.
Yeah.
The big thing about Robbie, and if you don't know what the French Resistance is and you watch this as a younger viewer, it's probably going to go right over your head. And it's important to the context in that Robbie is a thief, right? And
mm-hmm.
I love there's no subtlety to this. It's right in his name, Robbie, right?
Yeah.
Rob. Okay? So here's this guy who was part of this whole network of thieves in France in the 40s. And basically, they turned to the French Resistance to help out their French Resistance, and now they've supposedly all gone straight. So now they've been honored, right? So his
mm-hmm.
thing is, the first person they look at, because it follows his MO, the crime here, is him. And they want to arrest
yeah.
him, and they want to put him away because they're convinced he's the one, right? So without that context, it doesn't make much sense for them. It doesn't make much sense. His whole motivation is to clear himself, right? So he
yeah.
needs to find out who the real cat is, right? And the whole thing is that whole thing about him, it grounds his character and who he is, because this is a guy who legitimately criminal back in the day. But he's gone the straight and narrow path. He helped the French with the resistance in the war, and now he's being accused himself. And again, this is where you get your criminal, your typical Hitchcock thing. This is the wrong man accused, right?
Yeah.
So that brings us to his motivation for clearing himself, which is, hey, he hooks up with this insurance guy who
yeah.
they decide, the two of them, that he's going to pretend. It sounds ridiculous. He's going to pretend to be an oil baron from Oregon, right? And he's going to clear himself by, you know, living at the hotel, pretending that he's this big ritzy player, and then he's going to catch the thief.
Right.
And I really like the setup on it. And then there's that great scene at the beginning, and it's so cool because he's got the black and white horizontally striped shirt on. So
mm-hmm.
it just grounds this movie for what it is. Where the cops are in his house, and he's like, "Yeah, I just got to change here," and then he escapes. And you know, this just shows you how foolish the French police are, right? They can't catch a guy when they're in his house, and he's just
mm-hmm.
upstairs, right? So he's already miles ahead. I think. Well, how do you feel about the setup? I really love it.
It's great because of the fact that it is fun because of the fact that it's like you watch all of these jewels be taken, and you just, it almost like you almost hear, you just hear the aftermath of the robberies. You don't
yep.
necessarily, you basically hear the screams. You don't necessarily see the victims until I think the last one is the one that they show, and that basically sets the film into the direction it goes. But yeah, I mean, John Robey as the cat burglar. Now, and I, you know, and it's funny because of the fact that you don't really, when you were talking about it in perspective of Third Man, I didn't necessarily think about it because, I mean, I knew that the French Resistance angle was a big part of the movie, or at least in terms of John's character, but I didn't necessarily think about it in the same way that we discuss it when it comes to Third Man.
Well, yeah, but here's why, though. With the Third Man, like we talked about then, the director is filming scenes on actual rubble that was created by real bombs that were dropped on that city in a real war.
Yeah, this is a decade after the fact.
Everything's cool. We're just hanging out with Cary Grant in his swim trunks on the beach.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a decade after the fact. Not really
pick up on that. I guess it's if you don't understand what the French Resistance is, it wouldn't kill the movie, I wouldn't think, for a modern audience. But it certainly does help in grounding his motivation for clearing himself, because he's basically cleaned up his act. He's no longer what he was, you know. He's been
when it does that, and it also levels it also brings a sense of nobility to the character that is important for us to understand that he's ultimately not a bad guy. I mean, he really isn't. It's like you even hear him talking to Houston, the insurance investigator, played by the British actor John Williams, not the composer, who's actually 94 today. But you hear him, you know, they have that lunch at Robey's house, and he's like, you know, in a way you're a thief too. Like everybody has these moments where we steal, you know, and he brings it up in a way that's very logical for him. And you also do kind of get the feeling that Robey is somebody who he's kind of a Robin Hood type character, right? He didn't steal from people who couldn't afford to replace what was stolen.
100%. Yeah.
And, I mean, so there you've got a sense of an ethical code to the character that's being built just out of these little details. And, you know, the screenplay by John Michael Hayes, who also wrote Rear Window and Trouble with Harry for Hitchcock, This is what's so masterful about Hitchcock when it comes to the way he would work with writers. And it's like, you have to feel, I know this is based on a novel, but you have to feel like Hitchcock probably brought a lot of influence to this and made sure that it's like, well, Robey can't be that bad of a guy. So, you know, we want to be on his side. It's important for us to be on his side. And
well,
so
it's the Indiana Jones thing, you know.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones does some unscrupulous things in the name of archaeology, right?
Yes, he does.
But Indiana Jones is always looking to get. If you look at the beginning of the Last Crusade, his whole thing with the cross and that whole first 8 minutes with
River Phoenix,
River Phoenix playing him. That whole thing is to establish that it belongs in a museum. Hey, look,
right.
I'm stealing it from you because you're trying to steal it from these guys who are trying to steal it from this place. It doesn't belong to any of us. So I'm a thief just like you are, but I'm a thief with a righteous motive, you know?
Yeah.
So, I certainly understand and think that you're supposed to like Cary Grant. He's not, you know, he's like you said, he may be dealing in some gray stuff or was back in the day. But again, he's stealing from people who can certainly afford it. And even these people that are getting stolen from, like this insurance company, going to cover all this stuff. So they're not going to have to worry about that. They won't have the actual jewels, but they'll have the money to replace them, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he meets Grace Kelly's character, Frances Stevens, who is vacationing with her mother, Jessie, played by Jesse Royce Landis. And we basically, what we see from Frances is she is going to be, she's curious about John, and she comes to realize who John is. And it's like, it's not completely, I mean, she lays it out, but the fact of the matter is, it's like, it's hard to imagine that she would still kind of be able to figure out all of this from clues that she gives him in terms of, well, you know, this is how I figured out that you're who you are not saying you are.
I get from her character that she's bored. She travels around with a mother. Her mother wants to set her up with all these rich guys, and she's bored. And then she comes across Cary Grant, and she's intrigued.
Mm-hmm.
So here's someone with a little depth, maybe a little bit of danger, and she wants to get, once she finds out, she's super involved because she wants to get into something, and he basically lets her know, hey, you're in way over your head here. Like, you don't know what this is all about. Like, even if you can figure out what I am, you don't really understand fully what's going on here. And this is right. Just like a game for you to keep you interested because you're just a bored rich girl, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But even with that character, she builds it where I like her character too. You know, she wants to get involved. She's part of this. And she's freaking Grace Kelly. I mean, really.
Yeah.
How can you go wrong with that?
Well, and it's one of those things where it's like you don't care how they get together. You just know that they do. And you just know that it's important that they do get together. And so, you know, you don't think about it. It's like, oh, well, it's Cary Grant and Grace Kelly. Of course they're going to get together. And I do like that Frances, one of the things I do like about Frances is that, yes, she's a bored, rich girl. And what she finds in John is she's intrigued by who he is, even if he's not who he says he is. And you get the feeling right away that he charms Jesse, her mother as well. And that's, I think that's important to the story. And it's basically kind of like the three of them to a certain extent, not in a romantic way, but at least it becomes mother and daughter become part of the scheme by the end of it in terms of, you know, after, of course, there's a robbery at the hotel, and she thinks that he's stolen her mother's jewelry. And, of course, he hasn't. And there's just a wonderful... This movie is just so breezy and light, and it captures that tone just so effortlessly. It does feel like going on vacation with these characters, and it's like, but it's still telling us an interesting story when we do that.
I also like the fact that this film is always on the move.
Yeah.
And it's not just when characters are moving, it's the way they're edited as well. So
mm-hmm.
Robbie is in his house, escapes, he ends up on a bus. He then ends up in a restaurant with a bunch of, you know, the guy who owns the restaurant is basically everyone on staff there is part of that thief group that was in the French resistance. He goes
right.
to them to find out. He's like, hey, listen, I need some help here because they're accusing me and I don't know who this is. Oh, it couldn't be any of us, right? So then the police show up there. The guy's daughter gets him on the boat and all of a sudden they're off again. Like, the film's constantly moving, right?
Yeah.
Location, even the way it's cut, like there's a lot of fade outs and ins, and there's a lot of, you know, cut from one thing to the next, like quick cuts. And I think that editing on this film is a huge part of why it works. I think it's
oh, yeah.
successful in the way it's edited. But if I can, I'd like to talk about the core. Well, I guess the chase scene is what it is when he's going to check out the house. So, yeah. In a modern context, in a post-Marvel world, right? You think chase scene, you think guns, you think explosions, you think cutting in and out of traffic. You figure there's 5,000 things going on, bullets, explosions, all that. And those, sometimes those scenes when they cut like that are very, very boring for me because it's just like, this is so mechanical and by the numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you get a very different chase scene. You got a scene where a car is behind them and they know the car is behind them. They know they've been made, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like more like it fits in with the catch a thief thing. It's more like a cat and mouse chase here, right? So
yeah,
and the way it's edited, because it goes from real footage to obviously scenes with Cary Grant and Grace Kelly in front of a green screen, right? Okay.
Yeah,
but the way it's cut together, I don't get pulled out of the illusion. I don't get pulled out of the movie because of that. Because the way it's cut. And because of the way it's cut, and because they're working toward getting away from these guys who they know are tailing them, and the two guys are trying to keep up with them, and you know, you go through some typical stuff with in and out of traffic and all that, but basically the way it's cut, you don't need explosions, you don't need 5,000 cars that they're cutting in and out of, you don't need gunfire, you don't need any of that, because it's just a great way to edit that scene. And the way it's put together, like I said, the movie's constantly moving, and this is the perfect example of a scene that does exactly that, right?
Yes. No, and this is no. That it's an excellent sequence, and it's funny because of the fact that at this point we're still not quite sure how much Grace Kelly Francis knows about who he is, but she's just going along for the ride, and she enjoys this sequence because of the fact that it's an adventure for her.
It's a distraction. It's something to get her away from her boredom. You know?
Yeah.
So even on a character level, it fits. I just, it's a beautifully made movie, right? And
yeah.
Again,
yeah.
You know, it's not Rear Window. It's not. It doesn't have that kind of suspense. And it's not Vertigo, where that ending is absolutely, it's just shattering when you get to the point where what Vertigo ends up being in those last few minutes becomes what it is, right? And it's not Psycho. It's not
no.
based on a shower scene with 100 different cuts to show you a knife, you know, not actually penetrating a woman. It's none of that. But it's fun. It's just a good, fun film to watch. I love it every time I watch it. I watch it once a year or so, maybe. And every time I watch it, I'm just in love with it all over again. You know?
Yeah, it had been a few years since I'd seen it before I watched it again in preparation for this episode, and it is absolutely beautiful. The cinematography in this movie is so good. The narrative is just so light on its feet and effortless and just fun. So, I mean, we haven't even really talked about the character of Danielle, who is the daughter of one of the people who Roby worked with in the French Resistance, and she is played by Bridget Auber. There's a scene between her, Kelly, and Grant at a floating dock off of the beach that is just so wonderful. It has a lot of heat to it because of the fact that Danielle is somebody who clearly has affection for Roby that is not reciprocated. And for, you know, for good reason, like she's considerably younger. And she finds herself being intimidated by Francis. And you get these quips between the characters. And it's just absolutely it's just such a wonderful sequence between them.
Well, no pun intended, but it gets very catty, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's funny because Cary Grant looks like he just wants to drown himself to get away from both of these kids talking about him because he's stuck in the middle of this.
Yeah.
She's clearly infatuated with him. You know, they set that up when she's got him. She's got him on a boat escaping the restaurant to get him to the Riviera there in Cannes. Yeah. And, you know, a big part of it is that he's obviously not returning any kind of affection. Like you said, he's older and he's in a much different spot in his life. And
yeah,
then you get to that scene on the dock and it's brilliantly written. I love it. And it just, I can feel Cary Grant's skin, your Roby skin crawling on the back of his neck saying, oh my God, just get out of here.
Yeah.
But that plays into the ending. And, you know, I mean, if you want to knock this, you could say, hey, it's not really much of a mystery because, well, I mean, there's not many people who it could be. And, yeah, you know, it's not much of a mystery on that. There's not much real, it's not real Titan suspense. But again, it's not made for that. That's not what it's built for, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, it's built for us to watch Cary Grant and Grace Kelly be effortlessly charming for an hour, 45 minutes. I mean, that's no, quite literally what it is. And, I mean, God bless it, too, because of the fact that it is in every way, shape, or form. And I think, you know, one of the things that is so much fun about this movie is the fact that you're right, because of the fact that the end you're basically like at a certain point you realize it's going to be at least one of the characters that you've met, and chances are there are several you're going to be able to rule out immediately. And so no, the revelation is not really a surprise, but seeing how it unfolds, I mean, you know, there's another chase scene on the roof of during that climax that's really well put together because the police are convinced that it's Roby. Just completely, they think he is, and they're, you know, with Houston, Francis, Jesse, and John have put on this ruse that gives John enough time to sort of investigate and realize who the person is. And there's a chase on the roof that's, you talk about editing, it's just so well edited. In how simple it is, because of the fact that it's shot in darkness, it takes place at night, you see these shadows of people going up on the roof, and they don't necessarily see the real burglars' shadows until later, and it's just such a wonderful sequence.
Oh, it's masterfully done, and we should talk about that. It's part of a larger scene where it's this costume ball, and
yeah,
basically there's a bunch of subterfuge going on where you think, well, I knew immediately watching it that it wasn't, you know, Roby.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it turns out that it's actually the insurance inspector there. Mm-hmm. But it's very well put together, the way with the masks, and then are they arresting the right guy or the wrong guy? What's going on here? He's there with the ladies, but is he really? And, you know, it's very well done. And I don't think the French police would have taken very kindly to this movie when it was released.
Certainly, I mean, when you can
look like buffoons.
Well, I mean, when you consider a decade later was the start of the Inspector Clouseau franchise. True. With A Shot in the Dark and To Catch a in the Pink Panthers. Like, there's not really a lot of love for the French police in movies, is there?
No. So, again, when it turns out to be Danielle at the end, she's working for I believe it's the guy who runs the restaurant, right?
Yeah.
She's not. She's doing the physical work. Because it turns out that the police tried to make it sound like, oh, it's this, the guy that gets killed. They're like, oh, well, we killed him and caught him. But there's a scene earlier with Cary Grant with that character, and he's got a considerable limp, I believe, because he lost a leg. He's got a prosthetic leg.
It's
So Cary
exactly what
Grant
it
goes to
is.
the police, and he's like, interesting that you caught a guy who, could probably never climb a roof with a prosthetic leg.
Yeah,
So.
exactly.
And then, of course, it all leads up beautifully to that last scene where he's back at his house at the end. Business has been restored. Everything's fine. He's been, he's no longer under suspicion. Grace Kelly shows up, and clearly they're going to continue their romance. And she's like, well, my mother's going to love it when you move her in. I think that's a really funny end joke to end it on.
Oh no, yeah, absolutely. I mean that's one of the things that's so great about, I mean, that similar type of, and that kind of, that ending is sort of similar to what Stanley Donen did about a decade later with Charade, with Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, where it's like it's just this fun little joke and thing that makes things out that makes things realize, yeah, this went exactly as you expected it to go. It's fun. We hope you enjoyed it. And no, there was something. Yeah, you mentioned the ending, but of course you also have to bring up the fireworks scene, which
Oh, of
is
course.
one of the most wonderful romantic sequences ever, because of the fact that it's going between this dialogue with Cary Grant and Grace Kelly. It's intercutting the fireworks that are happening, and it's just a beautiful sequence.
I don't really think sexy most times when I think Alfred Hitchcock, but that is a very sexy scene with two very sexy people. Some very sexy dialogue and some sexy fireworks, yeah.
Yeah, I mean yeah, and then later he would do that again with Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint in North by Northwest. Not that exact sequence, but that sexual appeal of the two characters really leaning into it. And yeah, I think, it just depends on there was something about Cary Grant at the that he re it's Cary Grant. He recognized that Cary Grant's just people are
Brian, he is the textbook definition of suave, right?
he's suave. He's the definitive romantic lead in movies.
A
I
hundred
mean, it
percent.
really is.
Like, if you look back in the history of film, I don't think there's ever been a greater romantic lead than Cary Grant. He knew what he was. He knew how to get everything he needed out of a role. He could be in serious movies. He could be in something lighter like this. He could be in comedies like That Touch of Mink with Doris Day. He could span the gambit, but he knew what he was and what he was bringing, and he was always on top of his game. I can't ever fault him for not giving us a great performance. So let me ask you a question here. Do you prefer this pairing with Kelly and Grant, or do you prefer Rear Window with Jimmy Stewart and Kelly?
Are we talking about the film as a whole, or are we talking
I'm talking
about?
about the chemistry between the two. It's a whole different vibe between the two, right?
It's a very different vibe because of the fact that Kelly in Rear Window is, in a way, she's almost the conscience of Jimmy Stewart's character in a lot of ways. And also a little bit more mothering because of the fact that she's trying to take care of him as
He's wounded, yes.
as he's wounded. I mean, no. I mean, I love. I think Rear Window is a fantastic film. It's not one that I feel the need to revisit a lot. Like, I'm much more interested in revisiting this one because of almost entirely because of the chemistry between Grant and Kelly, and
Oh,
just how
absolutely.
effortless this is.
And I think if you put Jim Kelly in the role of Jim Kelly, Jesus, sorry. If you put Jimmy Stewart in the role of Roby in this movie, I don't think it's nearly as fun. I mean,
no,
I'm sure
he, no, that, he, but. And it's funny because of the fact that it's like everybody really thinks about Jimmy Stewart in the context of Frank Capra's work, right? Like,
yes.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, It's a Wonderful Life. But I mean, even in It's a Wonderful Life, he gets played dark. And as the movie goes on, and I think it's that disarming darkness that was so interesting to Hitchcock when he and Stewart collaborated. You think about Rope, you think about Rear Window, you think obviously about Vertigo.
Yeah.
And even The Day or The Man Who Knew Too Much remake, yeah, benefits from him being a very different feeling main character than Cary Grant is.
Yeah, certainly. And you know, you're talking two great actors when you're talking Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
But you're talking two very different actors. And I think that for the films that he made with Jimmy Stewart, Hitchcock picked Jimmy Stewart perfectly for those. And I think the same thing with Grant. I think if you switched either one of those guys in any one of these movies, you're talking a whole different acting style. You're talking a different appeal. You're talking a different chemistry. And I just think that I obviously prefer Grant and Grace Kelly here, but you can't go wrong with Grant. You can't go wrong with Grace Kelly and Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window. Like you said, it's just a totally different type of thing you're looking at, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, going back to Grant, one of my favorite early American Hitchcock films is Suspicion, where he plays the villain to Joan Fontaine. And it was so striking seeing him in that role because of the fact that I had seen enough Cary Grant at that time, at the time I first saw Suspicion, that I just figured him, oh, he's automatically going to be the good guy. No, yep. He's not really in Suspicion. And so I thought that was such a, but again, it plays off of, you know, Hitchcock understood what you get from Cary Grant and he found a way to subvert it, similar to what he does with Jimmy Stewart later on.
It's just so funny because there's that famous quote where Alfred Hitchcock basically says actors are just cattle, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think he really believed that because he knew inherently, like, again, even though I'm not a huge fan, I can watch any of his movies and enjoy them on some level, you know? But he knew how to get the best out of his actors in every one of his films.
Yeah.
And especially when you're working with big stars like Grant and Kelly and, you know, Jimmy Stewart and Paul Newman, you know, Sean Connery at one point down the line.
Yep.
Working with all these actors that are totally different on a million different levels, like they're bringing different things, but he knew how to perfectly suit what they brought to the game into his films in every one of them. I think that was one of his better aspects. And again, that thing about actors being cattle, I mean, I think that just kind of dismisses, and nobody really talks about his great work with actors and fitting them into the movies for what they're capable of and what they bring to the game, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's not to say that he treated actors greatly all the time. He certainly didn't. There were certainly stories that he did not, especially when it comes to some of the female leads of, like, Kim Novak in particular was a good example of that. Tippi Hedren during Marnie is an excellent example of that, which we talked about both of those in a, not with Phil, but with my previous guest, Morgan, when we talked about Rebecca, Vertigo, and Marnie several years ago, we talked about that. And, you know, I think, but you're right. I do think he had a respect for the craft of acting that he didn't necessarily get the credit for when he was alive.
No, certainly, because everyone thinks of him and they think of, you know, the shooting, the editing, the plots.
Yeah.
And I think that because you have so many big name actors in these films, that that's always like the seventh or eighth or 12th focus when you talk about one of Hitchcock's films, which is why I particularly wanted to talk about this one, because obviously we started off by talking about the actors, right? Like this is clearly all the fun is clearly because of Grant and Kelly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they understand the assignment here, and you know, Hitchcock understands how he's going to use them. And Brian, I'll say it again. This is my favorite Hitchcock film, always will be, you know. He's done some incredible stuff, you know, and he's obviously, you know, a world-renowned director and made some of the most, you know, I would think that people would look back at him at this point and say he really established what suspense and mystery is all about. Like, even if you go back in the movies from the 80s and 90s and you look at suspense thrillers,
yeah,
Hitchcock's written all over them.
You look at the erotic thriller genre, it's basically derived from Hitchcock in every way, shape, or form.
Oh, 100%, you know?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. But
the thing with this particular film is that I'll probably go back to this in a year or so from now. Mm-hmm. And I'll get the same thrills out of it that I did when I watched it a couple months ago. Or I watched it again for this discussion tonight, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I think that is, I think to a certain extent, that's something that some people don't necessarily get about the whole idea of rewatching movies. It's like, you've seen it so many times. Is it, how can you, like, you know everything. It's like, yes, I do know everything about the movie. I recognize what's coming up and what is about to happen. I just love the act of watching it unfold. And it's like, it's when we talk about, like, I don't even know that I would put To Catch a Thief in my top 10 Hitchcock of all time as far as great films of his, but it is definitely my top five of favorites that I'm going to watch.
Sure.
Like, I'm going to watch it in over some of his other movies. I mean, I already talked about that when it came to Rear Window, where it's like, I recognize that Rear Window is an excellent film. I'm more likely to watch To Catch a Thief because I just get more entertainment value out of it.
Sure. And that's the thing, you know, there are some films I go back to, like the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers with Kevin McCarthy is one of my favorite films. Don Siegel put together an excellent piece of work. I've seen that probably 70, 80 times, and every time I go back, I get a different thing out of it. Sometimes it's the love story. Sometimes I focus on the paranoia. Sometimes the music hits me. Like, it's a different thing every time, right? Mm-hmm. With To Catch a Thief, it's like that comfortable set of gloves you have that you're going to put on, you know, you need to put on some gloves and you're going to go out in the cold, and they just fit so perfectly, right? And it's just
pleasant
to put those gloves on, and that's exactly how I feel about To Catch a Thief.
Yeah, it's just pleasant to watch. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, it really is. It's like, I enjoy watching every minute of this movie. There's not a moment of this movie where I'm not just enjoying the process of watching a movie. Like, it's like, yeah, I love this. It's great.
100%. And I will go back to this every time. And I'm so glad that we got to talk about this today, because, you know, I told you I'm not a big Hitchcock guy. So twice in recent history now we've discussed Hitchcock films. And if you ever want to go back to Hitchcock again, I'm certainly willing to deep
don't jump back in the catalog. We pick something interesting, but yeah, I'm glad we focused on this today.
No, and it's good because of the fact that it's like, you know, this last year was a pretty heavy year for the podcast. Like you were on the Fascism and Cinema series, so it's like you know the impetus of that series. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And there were just a lot of other things going on that really made it feel like there was a particular direction that I wanted to take the podcast in last year. This year, you know, this is the now, like the first episode we talked about Rapture Cinema, which we're talking about some heavier subjects, but we're also talking about some terrible movies, so it bounces out. Like this last episode we talked about Rachel McAdams movies, and it's like, yes, let's get back into now. I mean, there are gonna be more episodes in Fascism and Cinema, there are gonna be other serious discussions that I have, but it's like, let's get to talking about movies again. And so when we decide, oh, this is one that I want to do early on this year, I'm glad that this is something that is happening early on in the year, because then we can go, okay, this is a movie podcast, so we're going to be talking about fun movies again. And I, you know, that won't necessarily always be the case, but the fact of the matter is, it's like this type of episode, this type of movie is uncomplicated to discuss. And Phil, I'm so glad I was able to talk about it with you. It's always a pleasure. It's always fun. And we'll definitely, I'll definitely look forward to the next time you're on the podcast.
Hey, look, the last few times I was on, we talked about War of the Worlds, which is, I mean, we talked about some deep, depressing, you know, dark stuff in those films. You know, it's not just throwaway sci-fi stuff. And then we talked about, you know, the militarism and stuff. But really, I mean, there's a time and a place for that, certainly.
Yeah.
But there's also a time and a place just to sit down in the dark, nice glass of soda, some popcorn, whatever, and just enjoy film for the joy of film. And I'm so happy and privileged and honored that you invited me on to talk about this, because Catch a Thief is the perfect example of that type of film.
You're welcome, and I could not agree more. I'd like to thank Phil for joining me on the podcast today. That's going to be it for this episode of the Song Cinema Podcast. Pretty short episode, but we're only talking about one movie. We're talking about a movie that is light on its feet, that's entertaining, doesn't have a whole lot of the heaviness that we've talked about here on past episodes recently. We will get to that in the next episode, though. But for now, thank you very much for continuing to join the podcast. Thank you for continuing to check us out wherever you check us out, at Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, YouTube, wherever. You can also check us out at patreon.com/sonicsinema, and more importantly, www.sonic-cinema.com.